Corbin left the palace without a word or backward glance for Toga, whom he had startled out of a nap by slamming open Akio's office doors. Striding along the corridor, down the stairs, down the other corridor, and through the doors to the drive with his eyes firmly front and face set in a grim mask. Without a word to the two startled soldiers standing at the gates to the road outside, he swung those gates open with a screech of iron and struck out for the city itself, bound for the bus station and a long, exhausting ride home. Behind him, he heard a familiar engine, and then a voice crying, "Ravenhair, wait!" He didn't slacken his pace. A few moments later, Akio's black Thunderbird roared up, checked with a chirp of tires on tarmac, and matched his pace at a rumbling idle. Nanami Kiryu was behind the wheel, and apparently alone. "Lord Akio sent me to take you home," Nanami said. "We can't let you walk." "I'll take the bus," Corwin said evenly. "Don't be like that," Nanami replied. "Come on, for form's sake, let me drive you home. It would reflect badly on our house if a guest we picked up was allowed to return to the Golden City on a bus." "Why should I care about how anything reflects on Akio Otori's house?"
"If I go back without you, I'll be punished," she told him. "Aren't knights supposed to help girls in trouble?"
Corbin stopped walking. Nanami braked the T-Bird to a halt. The two regarded each other across the open space of the passenger seat for a few seconds. Corbin cracked the faintest hint of a grin and climbed into the car, stretching out in the passenger seat. The road out of the pit wasn't as smooth as the one into it. It was a certain pleasure in that asymmetry, Corbin thought, but it didn't please him much when he could have been having a more restful nap. Still, even if he wasn't asleep, he was comfortable. The fact that he was so tired prevented him from doing what he normally would have done after an interview like that, which was rage around in circles for an hour or two, wishing he'd torn Akio Otori's head from his shoulders, whatever the cost. No doubt he'd do that in the morning. The raging, not the tearing. Instead, he sat slumped in the passenger seat of the Black Thunderbird, watching Nanami drive through half-hooded eyes. She was a good driver. She obviously enjoyed the work and liked the car, and what was more, she appreciated the car in a way that its owner did not. Corbin smiled a little. Out of the corner of her eye, she noticed it. "What?" she asked irritably. "You're a better driver than Akio," said Corbin. "You treat the car like a car, not a hammer." A hint of a blush crept into Nanami's cheeks under the scarlet brands of her demonhood. "No one asked you," she said defensively. Corbin raised an eyebrow. "You're not very kittenish now," he said. "What's the matter? I turned back into a pumpkin when I blew off your boss. Crossed off your temptation list. Don't think I'm cute anymore." Nanami scowled. "Do you have to ruin a perfectly nice drive by babbling?" she asked. "Don't get the idea that I wanted to be pawing at you like that. It's in my nature. When Lord Surtur translated me from damned soul to demon, he made me a succubus." Corwin frowned. "A refined, elegant girl like you. Shame. But I suppose that's why it's hell." "Shut up," Nanami snarled. And then, snottily sarcastic, "Sorry if I embarrassed you." Corbin shrugged. "I don't mind being petted by a pretty blonde now and then. Anyway, I wouldn't hold it against you. You can't help what you are." She glared at him and said coldly, "Don't. Go there." Corbin spread his hands. "Sorry. Peace. You know, even though you work for Akio, I don't really think of you as my enemy." "That's your problem," Nanami muttered, and she turned her full attention back to driving. She didn't seem able to sustain her anger with him, though. After a few more minutes of her driving and his drowsing, she said in a slightly forced conversational tone, "You want to listen to the radio? It only plays songs about cars, but..." She reached down, switched it on, and out came a driving beat and a high, clear voice. Caitlin's, Corwin realized with a mild thrill of surprise, singing.
Oh,
That's new, Nanami mused. The next song was the Beach Boys' version of 409. Nanami and Corwin looked at each other and shrugged, then went back to their previous activities, driving and drowsing, respectively. They said nothing more for most of the trip, but the silence wasn't particularly strained. In a way, it was almost companionable. In the hazy glow of his semi-wakeful state, Corwin came to the conclusion that he rather liked this girl, even though they were on opposite sides of such a vast gulf. The ruddy hills and scarlet skies of Muspelheim changed gradually to the gray of Niflheim, then the haze of hell, before finally the sky cleared and the stars came out. They were in Asgard, the snowstorm having ended while they were gone. As the Thunderbird spun up Highway 6 between the tall, cresting snowbanks thrown back by the Celestial Highway Department's plow trucks, Corwin glanced at the clock on the dash and saw that it was just a little shy of 2 a.m. Merry freaking Christmas, he told himself wryly, but he was too tired to really be as upset about it as he wanted to be. Golden City 45, said the first big green sign the T-Bird's headlights caught at a bend. So, said Nanami suddenly, jolting Corwin out of a renewed doze. Hmm? He said. You still hang around with the old crowd, right? Yeah, said Corwin. How's the genius doing? Huh? Corwin asked, confused. Miki, said Nanami impatiently. Is he doing all right? Didn't he and that sister of his ever sort each other out? Corwin blinked at her, clearing away the wool from his brain. Yeah, they're doing fine. Miki's spending Christmas with my sister. Kozue's working her butt off in a military academy. Kozue learned how to study? Corwin chuckled. Yeah. And Miki learned how to have fun. Wow, said Nanami. And then, in a softer tone that was almost snatched away by the Thunderbird's slipstream, maybe anything is possible. Nothing more was said until she pulled the T-Bird up to the curb in front of Corwin's apartment building on the Street of the Eternal Heroes. As the weary god climbed out into the pool of yellow light cast by the street lamp in front of the building, and into the shock of the cold winter's night after the warmth of the T-Bird's climate field, Nanami leaned across the seat and touched his arm. He looked down at her, blinking in sleepy query. "Want me to tuck you in?" she said with that odd, cold burlesque of seductiveness. "You're cuter when you're being natural," he observed, smashing the mask and bringing that little blush back to her cheeks. "Sorry," she said. "Force of habit." Then she paused for a second, the blush deepening, before going on in a quieter, more serious tone. "But the offer stands." For a very long moment, Corwin stood silently looking down at Nanami, his face blank. Despite his weariness, his first impulse had been to accept, his second, almost instantaneous, to decline. He made himself look at his reasons for the second impulse. Sure, she was a demon. So what? She was attractive and willing, and there wasn't a war on. Well, she might have been sent with instructions to do this. To what end? She couldn't hurt him. They'd have been seen together entering the city, and any hostile action on her part now could start a war, one the Pit was almost assuredly not prepared for. Besides, he didn't feel that kind of motive from her. Granted, he was tired and lonely, and possibly just trying to find something, anything, good to believe in here in this dark hour. But he thought there was more to his impression of her than that. Her face had gone so totally still and serious. Her slate-gray eyes were so steady and so very slightly sad. He would swear she'd restated the offer on the spur of the moment, that she hadn't had any intention of doing so a second before she actually said it. Anyway, without an agenda of harm, what other point would there be in ordering her to do it? He could hardly be ruined by scandal. He was an adult, a fully qualified divinity, and he was expected to make his own decisions about private matters. He had no one to answer to, no one at all. His last relationship had dissolved months before, for reasons he still didn't completely understand. Since then, he'd had an opportunity or two, here and there. He was handsome, likable, and eligible, after all, but he'd pass them up as gracefully as he could. Well, usually as gracefully as you could, he thought with a suppressed snort of self-mocking laughter, because of the same groundless, reflexive hesitation. "What the hell are you saving yourself for, Ravenhair?" he asked himself irritably. Even in his situation, bitterness was a thing largely alien to Corwin Ravenhair, but lack of rest and the raw smarting of the old wound Akio had ripped open combined to touch him with it now.
"Yeah," he said finally, his voice barely audible. "All right."
Without a word, Nanami climbed out of the Thunderbird and left it in front of the building. Corwin's extravagant weariness made him slow to respond, but Nanami didn't seem to mind. She took it slow and easy and did most of the work. It was almost more like she really was just tucking him in, putting a tired friend to bed after a long day, than a sexual coupling. She was good at her job. That should have come as no surprise. Corwin had never heard of a succubus who was bad at it. But she also seemed genuinely to enjoy it, which he'd been given to understand was fairly rare. The seductresses of the pit were good fakers, but their repertoires were famously limited, and did not include the kind of complex, gentle, almost ceremonious gratification involved here. Succubi on the clock might have fun, but they were never moved, and didn't bother to act like they were. Somehow, she didn't seem surprised when, at the end, he buried his face in her soft, pale shoulder and began to cry. She simply held him, stroked his hair, murmured to him, the way a normal person would comfort a grief-stricken friend. Corwin raised his eyes to hers, a question shining in them behind the tears. Nanami looked at him with a solemn gravity he hadn't seen on her face before, and when she spoke, her voice was hushed and entirely without sarcasm. "You're still in love with her, aren't you?" she asked, but it wasn't really a question. Corwin looked back at her, nodded once, and said in a whisper,
"Yeah, I still am. I think I always will be."
Nanami nodded.
"I thought so. He went too far," she added softly. "He always goes that one step too far. I saw it in your eyes."
She sighed resignedly.
"I can't imagine what it must feel like to love someone that way. I thought I did once, but..."
She shivered slightly in his arms.
"But I was so very, very wrong."
Before he could ask, she glanced across at the glowing numbers of his bedside clock and said hastily,
"I have to get back. I'll already have to explain why I'm so late."
"Tell him you made one last try at recruiting me," Corwin suggested with a trace of wryness. Nanami gave him a small, rather shy smile, wrinkling her nose a little, and said,
"Maybe I'll do that. It'll get Toga's goat. He really hates you for some reason."
"Kozue," Corwin said, rising and fumbling with his pants in the dark. "If you've been scrying on us, then he knows we used to live together, that she's turned her life around."
That's probably it," Nanami agreed. "You don't have to get up," she added, shrugging as she did back into her own jacket.
"Walk you down," he replied, throwing on his tunic without bothering to button it.
"You're my guest,"
he added with a dry, quiet chuckle. And indeed he did walk her down to the curb. The street of the Eternal Heroes was pitch black and silent, dawn still hours away, as she paused beside the T-Bird, turned, and impulsively kissed him.
"Thanks for this," she told him with an air of slightly forced flippancy, the tone of a person who is speaking truth, but phrases it as a joke to keep it from stinging as much. "It was nice. I've always wondered what it would be like with somebody who at least didn't hate me."
She chuckled with a wryness that hid the pain of the irony and added,
"My only Christmas present. Merry Christmas to me."
Then she hurtled the side of the car, slipping effortlessly behind the wheel, and fired up the engine. Turning her head to Corwin, she tossed her blonde hair behind her and said offhandedly,
"See you around, hero. Merry Christmas to you, too."
"Nanami," Corwin blurted suddenly, putting his hand back onto the top of the car door. Nanami stopped reaching for the gearshift lever and looked questioningly at him. He hesitated. What was he planning to do? Ask her to defect? It happened sometimes. It would endanger her, certainly. The creature who called himself her master nowadays was a dangerous and vengeful individual, and his master was worse. But if she stayed in Asgard, under the protection of a grandson of Odin, the son of a Norn... But he looked at her face and knew he couldn't suggest it. He had never met Nanami before, but he'd heard of her a great deal, mainly from Anthy, who still regretted all she'd gone through for helping the Rose Bride in darker times. This blonde shadow had been a proud girl once, and though she had fallen far and suffered much, some dark reflection of that pride remained in her. Surtur would have seen to that when he raised her from the dead. Without it, her new station in the cosmos wouldn't hurt her. Corwin had seen the spark of pride in her eyes in the dark. She was proud of herself for the first time in who knew how long, proud and pleased at having given freely of what her infernal design expected her to sell to her master's advantage, for no cause greater than an obscure solidarity and a fledgling friendship. It had been as much a gesture of defiance against her fate as an expression of affection for him. He knew that, and it pleased him. It would wound that pride to the bone if he offered her his protection now. She would take it as something like an offer of payment for the service she'd just rendered. She would think that he was, after all, viewing what had passed between them as a transaction, and he would be damned if he would make her think that when he looked at her, he saw a horror. What he saw was a deeply wounded, movingly courageous soul, and though he knew she needed help, he also knew he could not offer it right now without destroying the fragile trust that had sprung up between them. Inwardly, Corwin cursed himself for his weakness and stupidity. If he'd thought to suggest it when they'd first arrived in the Golden City, before she'd made her offer, or if he'd at least deferred his acceptance until he'd had a chance to make the proposal first. But now it was too late. He wouldn't be able to persuade her to stay, and if he brought it up now, he would only make her leave in anger instead of peace. Another day, then. He cringed inwardly at the thought of sending her back to that life, to errands in the pit and the leering caricature of her brother, to Akio, who he had sworn to destroy. But he had no choice. And besides, with that spark of pride still in her, bolstered by her choices here today, she would be all right. Nanami would survive until the reckoning came, and no fiber of Corwin doubted that there would be one. This time she was not mad, not broken-willed, and if she were careful, so she would remain. All this ran through his mind, weary but suddenly racing, in the space of perhaps 5 seconds, as Nanami waited with a quiet, expectant look. And though it was an inadequate thing to say after all the things that had just run through his mind, the only thing Corwin, his tired face drawn and serious again, could think to do was lean over the passenger seat, kiss her softly on the cheek, and say in a hushed voice, "Take care of yourself." "So what do you care?" she replied, her voice almost inaudible, gray eyes shimmering in the yellow glow of the street lamp. "Knights are supposed to help girls in trouble," he said, coming as close as he could to an offer. "Not this much trouble," Nanami replied. Then she put the car in gear, let out the clutch, and roared off down the street. Corwin watched the Thunderbird's taillights disappear around the end of the block. He stood there on the sidewalk listening until he could no longer hear the sound of the engine racing around the end of the world. Then he sighed all the way down to his toes, trudged back up the stairs, and went back to bed. Aerie Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 4, Intermezzo, Sympathy for the Devil. The cast, in order of appearance: Corwin Ravenhair, Toga Kiryu, Akio Otori, Nanami Kiryu, Anthy Tenjo. Road Trip into the Pit was Benjamin D. Hutchins. John Trussell was Cooler Man, and Ann Cross was Map Reader. And, of course, all the usual suspects. The Symphony will return.
I'm sorry, did I wake you?
Yes, but that's all right. What's wrong, Corwin? You sound sad.
I had a long day. How are you?
I'm fine. Are you sure you're all right?
Yeah. I'm okay now. Listen, the alert stepped down to level 3. The comm embargo's lifted, obviously. And I should be home in a couple of days. I just called to let you know before I go to bed. And to tell you I love you.
Oh, That's sweet of you, Corwin. I love you, too.
Merry Christmas, Anthony.
Merry Christmas, Corwin.